Chapter 5. The next evening, old Mr. Sillerton Jackson came to dine with the Archers. Mrs. Archer was a shy woman and shrank from society, but she liked to be well informed as to its doings. Her old friend Mr. Sillerton Jackson applied to the investigation of his friend's affairs the patience of a collector and the science of a naturalist, and his sister, Miss Sophie Jackson, who lived with him and was entertained by all the people who could not secure her much-sought-after brother, brought home bits of minor gossip that filled out usefully the gaps in his picture. Therefore, whenever anything happened that Mrs. Archer wanted to know about, she asked Mr. Jackson to dine. And as she honored few people with her invitations, and as she and her daughter Janie were an excellent audience, Mr. Jackson usually came himself instead of sending his sister. If he could have dictated all the conditions, he would have chosen the evenings when Newland was out. Not because the young man was uncongenial to him, the two got on capitally at their club, but because the old anecdotist sometimes felt on Newland's part a tendency to weigh his evidence that the ladies of the family never showed. Mr. Jackson, if perfection had been attainable on earth, would also have asked that Mrs. Archer's food should be a little better. But then New York, as far back as the mind of man could travel, had been divided into the two great fundamental groups of the Mingotts and Mansons and all their clan, who cared about eating and clothes and money, and the Archer Newland van der Luyden tribe, who were devoted to travel, horticulture, and the best fiction, and looked down on the grosser forms of pleasure. You couldn't have everything, after all. If you dined with the Lovell Mingotts, you got canvas back and terrapin and vintage wines. At Adeline Archer's, you could talk about alpine scenery and the marble fawn, and luckily the Archer Madeira had gone round the Cape. Therefore, when a friendly summons came from Mrs. Archer, Mr. Jackson, who was a true eclectic, would usually say to his sister, "I've been a little gouty since my last dinner at the Lovell Mingotts. It will do me good to diet at Adeline's." Mrs. Archer, who had long been a widow, lived with her son and daughter in West 28th Street. An upper floor was dedicated to Newland, and the two women squeezed themselves into narrower quarters below. In an unclouded harmony of tastes and interests, they cultivated ferns in Wardian cases, made macrame lace and wool embroidery on linen, collected American Revolutionary glazed ware, subscribed to Good Words, and read Ouida's novels for the sake of the Italian atmosphere. They preferred those about peasant life because of the descriptions of scenery and the pleasanter sentiments, though in general they liked novels about people in society whose motives and habits were more comprehensible, spoke severely of Dickens, who had never drawn a gentleman, and considered Thackeray less at home in the great world than Bulwer, who, however, was beginning to be thought old-fashioned. Mrs. and Miss Archer were both great lovers of scenery. It was what they principally sought and admired on their occasional travels abroad, considering architecture and painting as subjects for men, and chiefly for learned persons who read Ruskin. Mrs. Archer had been born in Newland, and mother and daughter, who were as like as sisters, were both, as people said, true Newlands, tall, pale and slightly round-shouldered, with long noses, sweet smiles, and a kind of drooping distinction like that in certain faded Reynolds portraits. Their physical resemblance would have been complete if an elderly embonpoint had not stretched Mrs. Archer's black brocade, while Miss Archer's brown and purple poplins hung, as the years went on, more and more slackly on her virgin frame. Mentally, the likeness between them, as Newland was aware, was less complete than their identical mannerisms often made it appear. The long habit of living together in mutually dependent intimacy had given them the same vocabulary, and the same habit of beginning their phrases, "Mother thinks," or "Janie thinks," according as one or the other wished to advance an opinion of her own. But in reality, while Mrs. Archer's serene unimaginativeness rested easily in the accepted and familiar, Janie was subject to starts and aberrations of fancy, welling up from springs of suppressed romance. Mother and daughter adored each other and revered their son and brother, and Archer loved them with a tenderness made compunctious and uncritical by the sense of their exaggerated admiration and by his secret satisfaction in it. After all, he thought it a good thing for a man to have his authority respected in his own house, even if his sense of humor sometimes made him question the force of his mandate. On this occasion, the young man was very sure that Mr. Jackson would rather have had him dine out, but he had his own reasons for not doing so. Of course old Jackson wanted to talk about Ellen Olenska, and of course Mrs. Archer and Janie wanted to hear what he had to tell. All three would be slightly embarrassed by Newland's presence, now that his prospective relation to the Mingott clan had been made known, and the young man waited with an amused curiosity to see how they would turn the difficulty. They began obliquely by talking about Mrs. Lemuel Struthers.
"It's a pity the Beauforts asked her," Mrs. Archer said gently. "But then Regina always does what he tells her. And Beaufort—"
"Certain nuances escape Beaufort," said Mr. Jackson, cautiously inspecting the broiled shad, and wondering for the thousandth time why Mrs. Archer's cook always burnt the roe to a cinder. Newland, who had long shared his wonder, could always detect it in the older man's expression of melancholy disapproval.
"Oh, necessarily. Beaufort is a vulgar man," said Mrs. Archer. "My grandfather Newland always used to say to my mother, 'Whatever you do, don't let that fellow Beaufort be introduced to the girls. But at least he's had the advantage of associating with gentlemen. In England, too, they say. It's all very mysterious." She glanced at Janie and paused. She and Janie knew every fold of the Beaufort mystery, but in public Mrs. Archer continued to assume that the subject was not one for the unmarried.
"But this Mrs. Struthers," Mrs. Archer continued.
"What did you say she was, Sillerton?"
"Out of a mine. Or rather out of the saloon at the head of the pit. Then with Living Waxworks touring New England. After the police broke that up, they say she lived—" Mr. Jackson in his turn glanced at Janie, whose eyes began to bulge from under her prominent lids. There were still hiatuses for her in Mrs. Struthers' past.
"Then—"
Mr. Jackson continued, and Archer saw he was wondering why no one had told the butler never to slice cucumbers with a steel knife.
"Then Lemuel Struthers came along. They say his advertiser used the girl's head for the shoe polish posters. Her hair's intensely black, you know, the Egyptian style. Anyway, he eventually married her."
There were volumes of innuendo in the way the "eventually" was spaced, and each syllable given its due stress.
"Oh, well, at the pass we've come to nowadays, it doesn't matter," said Mrs. Archer indifferently. The ladies were not really interested in Mrs. Struthers just then. The subject of Ellen Olenska was too fresh and too absorbing to them. Indeed, Mrs. Struthers' name had been introduced by Mrs. Archer only that she might presently be able to say, "And Newland's new cousin, Countess Olenska, was she at the ball, too?"
There was a faint touch of sarcasm in the reference to her son, and Archer knew it and had expected it. Even Mrs. Archer, who was seldom unduly pleased with human events, had been altogether glad of her son's engagement, especially after that silly business with Mrs. Rushworth, as she had remarked to Janie, alluding to what had once seemed to Newland a tragedy of which his soul would always bear the scar. There was no better match in New York than May Welland. Look at the question from whatever point you chose. Of course, such a marriage was only what Newland was entitled to. But young men are so foolish and incalculable, and some women so ensnaring and unscrupulous, that it was nothing short of a miracle to see one's only son safe past the Siren Isle and in the haven of a blameless domesticity. All this Mrs. Archer felt, and her son knew she felt. But he knew also that she had been perturbed by the premature announcement of his engagement, or rather by its cause. And it was for that reason, because on the whole he was a tender and indulgent master, that he had stayed at home that evening. It's not that I don't approve of the Mingott's esprit de corps, but why Newland's engagement should be mixed up with that Olenska woman's comings and goings, I don't see, Mrs. Archer grumbled to Janie, the only witness of her slight lapses from perfect sweetness. She had behaved beautifully, and in beautiful behavior she was unsurpassed, during a call on Mrs. Welland. But Newland knew, and his betrothed doubtless guessed, that all through the visit she and Janie were nervously on the watch for Madame Olenska's possible intrusion, and when they left the house together she had permitted herself to say to her son, "I'm thankful that Augusta Welland received us alone." These indications of inward disturbance moved Archer the more that he too felt that the Mingotts had gone a little too far. But, as it was against all the rules of their code that the mother and son should ever allude to what was uppermost in their thoughts, he simply replied, "Oh, well, there's always a phase of family parties to be gone through when one gets engaged, and the sooner it's over the better." At which his mother merely pursed her lips under the lace veil that hung down from her gray velvet bonnet, trimmed with frosted grapes. Her revenge, he felt, her lawful revenge, would be to draw Mr. Jackson that evening on the Countess Olenska, and having publicly done his duty as a future member of the Mingott clan, the young man had no objection to hearing the lady discussed in private, except that the subject was already beginning to bore him. Mr. Jackson had helped himself to a slice of the tepid fillet which the mournful butler had handed him with a look as skeptical as his own, and had rejected the mushroom sauce after a scarcely perceptible sniff. He looked baffled and hungry, and Archer reflected that he would probably finish his meal on Ellen Olenska. Mr. Jackson leaned back in his chair and glanced up at the candle-lit Archers, Newlands, and van der Luydens hanging in dark frames on the dark walls. "Ah, how your grandfather Archer loved a good dinner, my dear Newland," he said, his eyes on the portrait of a plump, full-chested young man in a stock and a blue coat, with a view of a white-columned country house behind him. "Well, well, well. I wonder what he would have said to all these foreign marriages." Mrs. Archer ignored the allusion to the ancestral cuisine, and Mr. Jackson continued with deliberation. "No, she was not at the ball." "Ah," Mrs. Archer murmured in a tone that implied she had that decency. "Perhaps the Beauforts don't know her," Janie suggested with her artless malice. Mr. Jackson gave a faint sip as if he had been tasting invisible Madeira. "Mrs. Beaufort may not, but Beaufort certainly does, for she was seen walking up Fifth Avenue this afternoon with him by the whole of New York." "Mercy!" moaned Mrs. Archer, evidently perceiving the uselessness of trying to ascribe the actions of foreigners to a sense of delicacy. "I wonder if she wears a round hat or a bonnet in the afternoon," Janie speculated. "At the opera I know she had on dark blue velvet, perfectly plain and flat, like a nightgown." "Janie," said her mother, and Miss Archer blushed and tried to look audacious. "It was, at any rate, in better taste not to go to the ball," Mrs. Archer continued. A spirit of perversity moved her son to rejoin, "I don't think it was a question of taste with her.
May said she meant to go, and then decided that the dress in question wasn't smart enough.
Mrs. Archer smiled at this confirmation of her inference. "Poor Ellen," she simply remarked, adding compassionately, "we must always bear in mind what an eccentric bringing up Medora Manson gave her. What can you expect of a girl who was allowed to wear black satin at her coming-out ball?"
"Ah, don't I remember her in it," said Mr. Jackson, adding, "poor girl," in the tone of one who, while enjoying the memory, had fully understood at the time what the sight portended.
"It's odd," Janey remarked, "that she should have kept such an ugly name as Ellen. I should have changed it to Elaine."
She glanced about the table to see the effect of this. Her brother laughed.
"Why Elaine?"
"I don't know. It sounds more Polish," said Janey, blushing.
"It sounds more conspicuous, and that can hardly be what she wishes," said Mrs. Archer distantly.
"Why not?" broke in her son, growing suddenly argumentative. "Why shouldn't she be conspicuous if she chooses? Why should she slink about as if it were she who had disgraced herself? She's poor Ellen, certainly, because she had the bad luck to make a wretched marriage, but I don't see that that's a reason for hiding her head as if she were the culprit."
"That, I suppose," said Mr. Jackson speculatively, "is the line the Mingotts mean to take."
The young man reddened.
"I didn't have to wait for their cue, if that's what you mean, sir. Madame Olenska has had an unhappy life. That doesn't make her an outcast."
"There are rumors," began Mr. Jackson, glancing at Janey.
"Oh, I know, the secretary." The young man took him up.
"Nonsense, mother. Janey's grown up."
"They say, don't they," he went on, "that the secretary helped her to get away from her brute of a husband who kept her practically a prisoner. Well, what if he did? I hope there isn't a man among us who wouldn't have done the same in such a case."
Mr. Jackson glanced over his shoulder to say to the sad butler,
"Perhaps that sauce, just a little after all."
Then, having helped himself, he remarked,
"I'm told she's looking for a house. She means to live here."
"I hear she means to get a divorce," said Janey boldly.
"I hope she will," Archer exclaimed.
The word had fallen like a bombshell in the pure and tranquil atmosphere of the Archer dining room. Mrs. Archer raised her delicate eyebrows in the particular curve that signified the butler, and the young man, himself mindful of the bad taste of discussing such intimate matters in public, hastily branched off into an account of his visit to old Mrs. Mingott. After dinner, according to immemorial custom, Mrs. Archer and Janey trailed their long silk draperies up to the drawing-room, where, while the gentlemen smoked below stairs, they sat beside a Carcel lamp with an engraved globe, facing each other across a rosewood work-table with a green silk bag under it, and stitched at the two ends of a tapestry band of field flowers destined to adorn an occasional chair in the drawing-room of young Mrs. Newland Archer. While this rite was in progress in the drawing-room, Archer settled Mr. Jackson in an armchair near the fire in the Gothic library and handed him a cigar. Mr. Jackson sank into the armchair with satisfaction, lit his cigar with perfect confidence — it was Newland who bought them — and stretching his thin old ankles to the coals, said,
"You say the secretary merely helped her to get away, my dear fellow. Well, he was still helping her a year later then, for somebody met him living at Lausanne together."
Newland reddened.
"Living together?"
"Well, why not? Who had the right to make her life over if she hadn't? I'm sick of the hypocrisy that would bury alive a woman of her age if her husband prefers to live with harlots."
He stopped and turned away angrily to light his cigar.
"Women ought to be free, as we are.
he declared, making a discovery of which he was too irritated to measure the terrific consequences. Mr. Sillerton Jackson stretched his ankles nearer the coals and emitted a sardonic whistle.
"Well," he said after a pause, "apparently Count Olenski takes your view, for I never heard of his having lifted a finger to get his wife back."
Chapter 6. That evening, after Mr. Jackson had taken himself away and the ladies had retired to their chintz-curtained bedroom, Newland Archer mounted thoughtfully to his own study. A vigilant hand had, as usual, kept the fire alight and the lamp trimmed, and the room, with its rows and rows of books, its bronze and steel statuettes of the fencers on the mantelpiece, and its many photographs of famous pictures, looked singularly homelike and welcoming. As he dropped into his armchair near the fire, his eyes rested on a large photograph of May Welland, which the young girl had given him in the first days of their romance, and which had now displaced all the other portraits on the table. With a new sense of awe, he looked at the frank forehead, serious eyes, and gay, innocent mouth of the young creature whose soul's custodian he was to be. That terrifying product of the social system he belonged to and believed in, the young girl who knew nothing and expected everything, looked back at him like a stranger through May Welland's familiar features. And once more it was borne in on him that marriage was not the safe anchorage he had been taught to think, but a voyage on uncharted seas. The case of the Countess Olenska had stirred up old settled convictions, and set them drifting dangerously through his mind. His own exclamation, "Women should be free as we are," struck to the root of a problem that it was agreed in his world to regard as non-existent. Nice women, however wronged, would never claim the kind of freedom he meant. And generous-minded men like himself were, therefore, in the heat of argument, the more chivalrously ready to concede it to them. Such verbal generosities were, in fact, only a humbugging disguise of the inexorable conventions that tied things together and bound people down to the old pattern. But here he was, pledged to defend, on the part of his betrothed's cousin, conduct that, on his own wife's part, would justify him in calling down on her all the thunders of church and state. Of course, the dilemma was purely hypothetical. Since he wasn't a blackguard Polish nobleman, it was absurd to speculate what his wife's rights would be if he were. But Newland Archer was too imaginative not to feel that, in his case in May's, the tie might gall for reasons far less gross and palpable. What could he and she really know of each other, since it was his duty as a decent fellow to conceal his past from her, and hers as a marriageable girl to have no past to conceal? What if, for some one of the subtler reasons that would tell with both of them, they should tire of each other, misunderstand or irritate each other? He reviewed his friends' marriages, the supposedly happy ones, and saw none that answered even remotely to the passionate and tender comradeship which he pictured as his permanent relation with May Welland. He perceived that such a picture presupposed on her part the experience, the versatility, the freedom of judgment which she had been carefully trained not to possess. And with a shiver of foreboding, he saw his marriage becoming what most of the other marriages about him were, a dull association of material and social interests held together by ignorance on the one side and hypocrisy on the other. Lawrence Lefferts occurred to him as the husband who had most completely realized this enviable ideal. As became the high priest of form, he had formed a wife so completely to his own convenience that, in the most conspicuous moments of his frequent love affairs with other men's wives, she went about in smiling unconsciousness, saying that, "Lawrence is so frightfully strict. and had been known to blush indignantly and avert her gaze when someone alluded in her presence to the fact that Julius Beaufort, as became a foreigner of doubtful origin, had what was known in New York as another establishment. Archer tried to console himself with the thought that he was not quite such an ass as Larry Lefferts, nor May such a simpleton as poor Gertrude. But the difference was, after all, one of intelligence and not of standards. In reality, they all lived in a kind of hieroglyphic world where the real thing was never said or done or even thought, but only represented by a set of arbitrary signs. As when Mrs. Welland, who knew exactly why Archer had pressed her to announce her daughter's engagement at the Beaufort Ball, and had indeed expected him to do no less, yet felt obliged to simulate reluctance and the air of having had her hand forced, quite as, in the books on primitive man that people of advanced culture were beginning to read, the savage bride is dragged with shrieks from her parents' tent. The result, of course, was that the young girl who was the center of this elaborate system of mystification remained the more inscrutable for her very frankness and assurance. She was frank, poor darling, because she had nothing to conceal, assured because she knew of nothing to be on her guard against, and, with no better preparation than this, she was to be plunged overnight into what people evasively called the facts of life. The young man was sincerely but placidly in love. He delighted in the radiant good looks of his betrothed, in her health, her horsemanship, her grace and quickness at games, and the shy interest in books and ideas that she was beginning to develop under his guidance. She had advanced far enough to join him in ridiculing the idols of the king, but not to feel the beauty of Ulysses and the Lotus Eaters. She was straightforward, loyal, and brave. She had a sense of humor, chiefly proved by her laughing at his jokes, and he suspected, in the depths of her innocently gazing soul, a glow of feeling that it would be a joy to waken. But when he had gone the brief round of her, he returned discouraged by the thought that all this frankness and innocence were only an artificial product. Untrained human nature was not frank and innocent. It was full of the twists and defenses of an instinctive guile. And he felt himself oppressed by this creation of factitious purity, so cunningly manufactured by a conspiracy of mothers and aunts and grandmothers and long-dead ancestresses, because it was supposed to be what he wanted, what he had a right to, in order that he might exercise his lordly pleasure in smashing it like an image made of snow. There was a certain triteness in these reflections. They were those habitual to young men on the approach of their wedding day, but they were generally accompanied by a sense of compunction and self-abasement of which Newland Archer felt no trace. He could not deplore, as Thackeray's hero so often exasperated him by doing, that he had not a blank page to offer his bride in exchange for the unblemished one she was to give to him. He could not get away from the fact that if he had been brought up as she had, they would have been no more fit to find their way about than the babes in the wood. Nor could he, for all his anxious cogitations, see any honest reason, any that is unconnected with his own momentary pleasure and the passion of masculine vanity, why his bride should not have been allowed the same freedom of experience as himself. Such questions at such an hour were bound to drift through his mind, but he was conscious that their uncomfortable persistence and precision were due to the inopportune arrival of the Countess Olenska. Here he was, at the very moment of his betrothal, a moment for pure thoughts and cloudless hopes, pitchforked into a coil of scandal which raised all the special problems he would have preferred to let lie. "Hang Ellen Olenska," he grumbled, as he covered his fire and began to undress. He could not really see why her fate should have the least bearing on his. Yet he dimly felt that he had only just begun to measure the risks of the championship which his engagement had forced upon him.
A few days later, the bolt fell. The Lovell Mingotts had sent out cards for what was known as a formal dinner, that is, 3 extra footmen, 2 dishes for each course, and a Roman punch in the middle, and had headed their invitations with the words, "To meet the Countess Olenska," in accordance with the hospitable American fashion, which treats strangers as if they were royalties, or at least as their ambassadors. The guests had been selected with a boldness and discrimination in which the initiated recognized the firm hand of Catherine the Great. Associated with such immemorial standbys as the Selfridge Marys, who were asked everywhere because they always had been, the Beauforts, on whom there was a claim of relationship, and Mr. Sillerton Jackson and his sister Sophie, who went wherever her brother told her to, were some of the most fashionable and yet most irreproachable of the dominant young married set. The Lawrence Leffertses, Mrs. Leffert's Rushworth, the lovely widow, the Harry Thorleys, the Reggie Chiverses, and young Morris Dragonet and his wife, who was a van der Luyden. The company, indeed, was perfectly assorted, since all the members belonged to the little inner group of people who, during the long New York season, disported themselves together daily and nightly with apparently undiminished zest. 48 hours later, the unbelievable had happened. Everyone had refused the Mingotts' invitation except the Beauforts and old Mr. Jackson and his sister. The intended slight was emphasized by the fact that even the Reggie Chiverses, who were of the Mingott clan, were among those inflicting it, and by the uniform wording of the notes, in all of which the writers regretted that they were unable to accept, without the mitigating plea of a previous engagement that ordinary courtesy prescribed. New York society was in those days far too small and too scant in its resources for everyone in it, including livery stable keepers, butlers, and cooks, not to know exactly on which evenings people were free. And it was thus possible for the recipients of Mrs. Lovell Mingott's invitations to make cruelly clear their determination not to meet the Countess Olenska. The blow was unexpected, but the Mingotts, as their way was, met it gallantly. Mrs. Lovell Mingott confided the case to Mrs. Welland, who confided it to Newland Archer, who, aflame at the outrage, appealed passionately and authoritatively to his mother, who, after a painful period of inward resistance and outward temporizing, succumbed to his instances, as she always did, and immediately embracing his cause with an energy redoubled by her previous hesitations, put on her gray velvet bonnet and said, "I'll go and see Louisa van der Luyden." The New York of Newland Archer's day was a small and slippery pyramid in which, as yet, hardly a fissure had been made or a foothold gained. At its base was a firm foundation of what Mrs. Archer called plain people, an honorable but obscure majority of respectable families who, as in the case of the Spicers or the Leffertses or the Jacksons, had been raised above their level by marriage with one of the ruling clans. People, Mrs. Archer always said, were not as particular as they used to be, and with old Catherine Spicer ruling one end of Fifth Avenue and Julius Beaufort the other, you couldn't expect the old traditions to last much longer. Firmly narrowing upward from this wealthy but inconspicuous substratum was the compact and dominant group which the Mingotts, Newlands, Chiverses, and Mansons so actively represented. Most people imagined them to be the very apex of the pyramid, but they themselves, at least those of Mrs. Archer's generation, were aware that in the eyes of the professional genealogist, only a still smaller number of families could lay claim to that eminence. "Don't tell me," Mrs. Archer would say to her children, "all this modern newspaper rubbish about a New York aristocracy. If there is one, neither the Mingotts nor the Mansions belong to it. No, nor the Newlands or the Chiverses either.
Our grandfathers and great-grandfathers were just respectable English or Dutch merchants who came to the colonies to make their fortune and stayed here because they did so well. One of your great-grandfathers signed the Declaration, and another was a general on Washington's staff and received General Burgoyne's sword after the Battle of Saratoga. These are things to be proud of, but they have nothing to do with rank or class. New York has always been a commercial community, and there are not more than three families in it who can claim an aristocratic origin in the real sense of the word.
Mrs. Archer and her son and daughter, like everyone else in New York, knew who these privileged beings were. The Dragonettes of Washington Square, who came of an old English county family allied with the Pitts and Foxes, the Lannings, who had intermarried with the descendants of Count de Grasse, and the Van der Luydens, direct descendants of the first Dutch governor of Manhattan, and related by pre-revolutionary marriages to several members of the French and British aristocracy. The Lannings survived only in the person of two very old but lively Miss Lannings, who lived cheerfully and reminiscently among family portraits and Chippendale. The Dragonettes were a considerable clan, allied to the best names in Baltimore and Philadelphia. But the Van der Luydens, who stood above all of them, had faded into a kind of super-terrestrial twilight from which only two figures impressively emerged, those of Mr. and Mrs. Henry Van der Luyden. Mrs. Henry Van der Luyden had been Louisa Dragonet, and her mother had been the granddaughter of Colonel Dulac, of an old Channel Island family who had fought under Cornwallis and had settled in Maryland after the war with his bride, Lady Angelica Trevenna, fifth daughter of the Earl of St. Austrey. The tie between the Dragonettes, the Dulacs of Maryland, and their aristocratic Cornish kinsfolk, the Trevennas, had always remained close and cordial. Mr. and Mrs. Van der Luyden had more than once paid long visits to the present head of the House of Trevenna, the Duke of St. Austrey, at his country seat in Cornwall, and at St. Austrey in Gloucestershire, and His Grace had frequently announced his intention of some day returning their visit, without the Duchess, who feared the Atlantic. Mr. and Mrs. Van der Luyden divided their time between Trevenna, their place in Maryland, and Schuylkill, the great estate on the Hudson, which had been one of the colonial grants of the Dutch government to the famous first governor, and of which Mr. Van der Luyden was still patroon. Their large, solemn house in Madison Avenue was seldom opened, and when they came to town they received in it only their most intimate friends. "I wish you would go with me, Newland," his mother said, suddenly pausing at the door of the brown coupé. "Louisa is fond of you, and— Of course it's on account of dear May that I'm taking this step, and also because if we don't all stand together, there'll be no such thing as society left." Chapter 7 Mrs. Henry Van der Luyden listened in silence to her cousin Mrs. Archer's narrative. It was all very well to tell yourself in advance that Mrs. Van der Luyden was always silent, and that, though noncommittal by nature and training, she was very kind to the people she really liked. Even personal experience of these facts was not always a protection from the chill that descended on one in the high-ceilinged, white-walled Madison Avenue drawing-room, with the pale, brocaded armchairs so obviously uncovered for the occasion, and the gauze still veiling the ormolu mantel ornaments and the beautiful old carved frame of Gainsborough's Lady Angelica Dulac. Mrs. Van der Luyden's portrait by Huntington, in black velvet and Venetian point, faced that of her lovely ancestress. It was generally considered as fine as a cabanel, and though 20 years had elapsed since its execution, was still a perfect likeness. Indeed, the Mrs. Van der Luyden who sat beneath it listening to Mrs. Archer might have been the twin sister of the fair and still youngish woman drooping against a gilt armchair before a green rep curtain. Mrs. Van der Luyden still wore black velvet and Venetian point when she went into society, or rather, since she never dined out, when she threw open her own doors to receive it. Her fair hair, which had faded without turning gray, was still parted in flat overlapping points on her forehead, and the straight nose that divided her pale blue eyes was only a little more pinched about the nostrils than when the portrait had been painted. She always, indeed, struck Newland Archer as having been rather gruesomely preserved in the airless atmosphere of a perfectly irreproachable existence, as bodies caught in glaciers keep for years a rosy life in death. Like all his family, he esteemed and admired Mrs. van der Luyden, but he found her gentle, bending sweetness less approachable than the grimness of some of his mother's old aunts, fierce spinsters who said no on principle before they knew what they were going to be asked. Mrs. van der Luyden's attitude said neither yes nor no, but always appeared to incline to clemency, till her thin lips, wavering into the shadow of a smile, made the almost invariable reply, "I shall first have to talk this over with my husband." She and Mr. van der Luyden were so exactly alike that Archer often wondered how, after 40 years of the closest conjugality, two such merged identities ever separated themselves enough for anything as controversial as a talking over. But as neither had ever reached a decision without prefacing it by this mysterious conclave, Mrs. Archer and her son, having set forth their case, waited resignedly for the familiar phrase. Mrs. van der Luyden, however, who had seldom surprised anyone, now surprised them by reaching her long hand toward the bell rope. "I think," she said, "I should like Henry to hear what you have told me." A footman appeared, to whom she gravely added, "If Mr. van der Luyden has finished reading the newspaper, please ask him to be kind enough to come." She said, "reading the newspaper," in the tone in which a minister's wife might have said, "presiding at a cabinet meeting," not from any arrogance of mind, but because the habit of a lifetime and the attitude of her friends and relations had led her to consider Mr. van der Luyden's least gesture as having an almost sacerdotal importance. Her promptness of action showed that she considered the case as pressing as Mrs. Archer. But lest she should be thought to have committed herself in advance, she added with the sweetest look, "Henry always enjoys seeing you, dear Adeline, and he will wish to congratulate Newland." The double doors had solemnly reopened, and between them appeared Mr. Henry van der Luyden, tall, spare, and frock-coated, with faded fair hair, a straight nose like his wife's, and the same look of frozen gentleness in eyes that were merely pale gray instead of pale blue. Mr. van der Luyden greeted Mrs. Archer with cousinly affability, proffered to Newland low-voiced congratulations couched in the same language as his wife's, and seated himself in one of the brocade armchairs with the simplicity of a reigning sovereign.
"I had just finished reading the Times," he said, laying his long fingertips together. "In town my mornings are so much occupied that I find it more convenient to read the newspapers after luncheon."
"Ah, there's a great deal to be said for that plan. Indeed, I think my Uncle Egmont used to say he found it less agitating not to read the morning papers till after dinner," said Mrs. Archer responsively.
"Yes, my good father abhorred hurry. But now we live in a constant rush," said Mr. van der Luyden in measured tones, looking with pleasant deliberation about the large shrouded room, which to Archer was so complete an image of its owners.
"But I hope you had finished your reading, Henry," his wife interposed.
"Quite, quite," he reassured her.
"Then I should like Adeline to tell you."
"Oh, it's really Newland's story," said his mother, smiling, and proceeded to rehearse once more the monstrous tale of the affront inflicted on Mrs. Lovell Mingott. "Of course," she ended, "Augusta Welland and Mary Mingott both felt that, especially in view of Newland's engagement, you and Henry ought to know."
"Ah," said Mr. van der Luyden, drawing a deep breath.
There was a silence during which the tick of the monumental ormolu clock on the white marble mantelpiece grew as loud as the boom of a minute-gun. Archer contemplated with awe the two slender, faded figures seated side by side in a kind of vice-regal rigidity, mouthpieces of some remote ancestral authority which fate compelled them to wield, when they would so much rather have lived in simplicity and seclusion, digging invisible weeds out of the perfect lawns of Skuytercliff and playing patience together in the evenings. Mr. van der Luyden was the first to speak.
"You really think this is due to some intentional interference of Lawrence Levert's?" he inquired, turning to Archer.
"I'm certain of it, sir. Larry has been going it rather harder than usual lately, if Cousin Louisa won't mind my mentioning it. Having rather a stiff affair with the postmaster's wife in their village, or someone of that sort. And whenever poor Gertrude Lefferts begins to suspect anything, and he's afraid of trouble, he gets up a fuss of this kind to show how awfully moral he is, and talks at the top of his voice about the impertinence of inviting his wife to meet people he doesn't wish her to know. He's simply using Madame Olenska as a lightning rod. I've seen him try the same thing often before."
"The Leffertses," said Mrs. van der Luyden.
"The Leffertses," echoed Mrs. Archer. "What would Uncle Egmont have said of Lawrence Lefferts pronouncing on anybody's social position? It shows what society has come to."
"We'll hope it has not quite come to that," said Mr. van der Luyden firmly.
"Ah, if only you and Louisa went out more," sighed Mrs. Archer. But instantly she became aware of her mistake. The van der Luydens were morbidly sensitive to any criticism of their secluded existence. They were the arbiters of fashion, the court of last appeal, and they knew it, and bowed to their fate. But being shy and retiring persons with no natural inclination for their part, they lived as much as possible in the sylvan solitude of Skuytercliff, and when they came to town declined all invitations on the plea of Mrs. van der Luyden's health. Newland Archer came to his mother's rescue.
"Everybody in New York knows what you and Cousin Louisa represent. That's why Mrs. Mingott felt she ought not to allow this slight on Countess Olenska to pass without consulting you."
Mrs. van der Luyden glanced at her husband, who glanced back at her.
"It is the principle that I dislike," said Mr. van der Luyden. "As long as a member of a well-known family is backed up by that family, it should be considered final."
"It seems so to me," said his wife, as if she were producing a new thought.
"I had no idea," Mr. van der Luyden continued, "that things had come to such a pass."
He paused and looked at his wife again.
"It occurs to me, my dear, that the Countess Olenska is already a sort of relation through Medora Manson's first husband. At any rate, she will be when Newland marries."
He turned toward the young man.
"Have you read this morning's Times, Newland?"
"Why, yes, sir," said Archer, who usually tossed off half a dozen papers with his morning coffee. Husband and wife looked at each other again. Their pale eyes clung together in prolonged and serious consultation. Then a faint smile fluttered over Mrs. van der Luyden's face. She had evidently guessed and approved. Mr. van der Luyden turned to Mrs. Archer.
"If Louisa's health allowed her to dine out, I wish you would say to Mrs. Lovell Mingott, she and I would have been happy to, fill the places of the Lawrence Leffertses at her dinner."
He paused to let the irony of this sink in.
"As you know, this is impossible."
Mrs. Archer sounded a sympathetic assent.
"But Newland tells me he has read this morning's Times. Therefore he has probably seen that Louisa's relative, the Duke of St. Austrey, arrives next week on the Russia. He is coming to enter his new sloop, the Guinevere, in next summer's International Cup race, and also to have a little canvasback shooting at Trevenna.
Mr. van der Luyden paused again and continued with increasing benevolence.
Before taking him down to Maryland, we are inviting a few friends to meet him here. Only a little dinner, with a reception afterward. I am sure Louisa will be as glad as I am if Countess Olenska will let us include her among our guests.
He got up, bent his long body with a stiff friendliness toward his cousin, and added,
I think I have Louisa's authority for saying that she will herself leave the invitation to dine when she drives out presently. With our cards.
Mrs. Archer, who knew this to be a hint that the 17 hand chestnuts which were never kept waiting were at the door, rose with a hurried murmur of thanks. Mrs. van der Luyden beamed on her with the smile of Esther interceding with Ahasuerus. But her husband raised a protesting hand.
There is nothing to thank me for, dear Adeline, nothing whatever. This kind of thing must not happen in New York. It shall not, as long as I can help it,
he pronounced with sovereign gentleness as he steered his cousins to the door.
2 hours later, everyone knew that the great sea spring barouche in which Mrs. van der Luyden took the air at all seasons had been seen at old Mrs. Mingott's door, where a large square envelope was handed in. And that evening at the opera, Mr. Sillerton Jackson was able to state that the envelope contained a card inviting the Countess Olenska to the dinner which the van der Luydens were giving the following week for their cousin, the Duke of St. Austrey. Some of the younger men in the club box exchanged a smile at this announcement and glanced sideways at Lawrence Lefferts, who sat carelessly in the front of the box, pulling his long fair moustache, and who remarked with authority as the soprano paused,
"No one but Patty ought to attempt the somnambula."
Chapter 8. It was generally agreed in New York that the Countess Olenska had lost her looks. She had appeared there first, in Newland Archer's boyhood, as a brilliantly pretty little girl of 9 or 10, of whom people said that she ought to be painted. Her parents had been continental wanderers, and after a roaming babyhood she had lost them both and been taken in charge by her aunt, Medora Manson, also a wanderer, who was herself returning to New York to settle down. Poor Medora, repeatedly widowed, was always coming home to settle down, each time in a less expensive house, and bringing with her a new husband or an adopted child. But after a few months she invariably parted from her husband or quarreled with her ward, and, having got rid of her house at a loss, set out again on her wanderings. As her mother had been a Rushworth, and her last unhappy marriage had linked her to one of the crazy Chiverses, New York looked indulgently on her eccentricities. But when she returned with her little orphaned niece, whose parents had been popular in spite of their regrettable taste for travel, people thought it a pity that the pretty child should be in such hands. Everyone was disposed to be kind to little Ellen Mingott, though her dusky red cheeks and tight curls gave her an air of gaiety that seemed unsuitable in a child who should still have been in black for her parents. It was one of the misguided Medora's many peculiarities to flout the unalterable rules that regulated American mourning, and when she stepped from the steamer, her family was scandalized to see that the crepe veil she wore for her own brother was 7 inches shorter than those of her sisters-in-law, while little Ellen was in crimson merino and amber beads, like a gypsy foundling. But New York had so long resigned itself to Medora that only a few old ladies shook their heads over Ellen's gaudy clothes, while her other relations fell under the charm of her high color and high spirits. She was a fearless and familiar little thing, who asked disconcerting questions, made precocious comments, and possessed outlandish arts, such as dancing a Spanish shawl dance and singing Neapolitan love songs to a guitar. Under the direction of her aunt, whose real name was Mrs. Thorley Chivers, but who, having received a papal title, had resumed her first husband's patronymic and called herself the Marchioness Manson, because in Italy she could turn it into Manzoni, the little girl received an expensive but incoherent education, which included drawing from the model, a thing never dreamed of before, and playing the piano in quintets with professional musicians. Of course, no good could come of this, and when, a few years later, poor Chivers finally died in a madhouse, his widow, draped in strange weeds, again pulled up stakes and departed with Ellen, who had grown into a tall, bony girl with conspicuous eyes. For some time no more was heard of them. Then news came of Ellen's marriage to an immensely rich Polish nobleman of legendary fame, whom she had met at a ball at the Tuileries, and who was said to have princely establishments in Paris, Nice, and Florence, a yacht at Cowes, and many square miles of shooting in Transylvania. She disappeared in a kind of sulphurous apotheosis, and when, a few years later, Medora again came back to New York, subdued, impoverished, mourning a third husband, and in quest of a still smaller house, people wondered that her rich niece had not been able to do something for her. Then came the news that Ellen's own marriage had ended in disaster, and that she was herself returning home to seek rest and oblivion among her kinsfolk. These things passed through Newland Archer's mind a week later as he watched the Countess Olenska enter the van der Luyden drawing-room on the evening of the momentous dinner. The occasion was a solemn one, and he wondered a little nervously how she would carry it off. She came rather late, one hand still ungloved and fastening a bracelet about her wrist. Yet she entered without any appearance of haste or embarrassment the drawing-room in which New York's most chosen company was somewhat awfully assembled. In the middle of the room she paused, looking about her with a grave mouth and smiling eyes, and in that instant Newland Archer rejected the general verdict on her looks. It was true that her early radiance was gone. The red cheeks had paled. She was thin, worn, a little older looking than her age, which must have been nearly 30. But there was about her the mysterious authority of beauty, a sureness in the carriage of the head, the movement of the eyes, which, without being in the least theatrical, struck his as highly trained and full of a conscious power. At the same time, she was simpler in manner than most of the ladies present, and many people, as he heard afterward from Janie, were disappointed that her appearance was not more stylish, for stylishness was what New York most valued. It was, perhaps, Archer reflected, because her early vivacity had disappeared, because she was so quiet, quiet in her movements, her voice, and the tones of her low-pitched voice. New York had expected something a good deal more resonant in a young woman with such a history. The dinner was a somewhat formidable business. Dining with the van der Luydens was, at best, no light matter, and dining there with a duke, who was their cousin, was almost a religious solemnity. It pleased Archer to think that only an old New Yorker could perceive the shade of difference to New York between being merely a duke and being the van der Luyden's duke. New York took stray noblemen calmly, and even, except in the Struthers set, with a certain distrustful hauteur. But when they presented such credentials as these, they were received with an old-fashioned cordiality that they would have been greatly mistaken in ascribing solely to their standing in Debrett. It was for just such distinctions that the young man cherished his old New York, even while he smiled at it. The van der Luydens had done their best to emphasize the importance of the occasion. The Du Lac Sèvres and the Trevenna George II plate were out. So was the van der Luyden Lowestoft East India Company, and the Dragonette Crown Derby. Mrs. van der Luyden looked more than ever like a Cabanel, and Mrs. Archer, in her grandmother's seed pearls and emeralds, reminded her son of an Issa Bay miniature. All the ladies had on their handsomest jewels, but it was characteristic of the house and the occasion that these were mostly in rather heavy old-fashioned settings. And old Mrs. Lanning, who had been persuaded to come, actually wore her mother's cameos and a Spanish blonde shawl. The Countess Olenska was the only young woman at the dinner. Yet, as Archer scanned the smooth, plump, elderly faces between their diamond necklaces and towering ostrich feathers, they struck him as curiously immature compared with hers. It frightened him to think what must have gone to the making of her eyes. The Duke of St. Austrey, who sat at his hostess's right, was naturally the chief figure of the evening. But if the Countess Olenska was less conspicuous than had been hoped, the Duke was almost invisible. Being a well-bred man, he had not, like another recent ducal visitor, come to the dinner in a shooting jacket, but his evening clothes were so shabby and baggy, and he wore them with such an air of their being homespun that, with his stooping way of sitting and the vast beard spreading over his shirt front, he hardly gave the appearance of being in dinner attire. He was short, round-shouldered, sunburnt, with a thick nose, small eyes, and a sociable smile. But he seldom spoke, and when he did, it was in such low tones that, despite the frequent silences of expectation about the table, his remarks were lost to all but his neighbors. When the men joined the ladies after dinner, the Duke went straight up to the Countess Olenska, and they sat down in a corner and plunged into animated talk. Neither seemed aware that the Duke should first have paid his respects to Mrs. Lovell Mingott and Mrs. Headley Chivers. And the Countess have conversed with that amiable hypochondriac Mr. Urban Dragonet of Washington Square, who, in order to have the pleasure of meeting her, had broken through his fixed rule of not dining out between January and April. The two chatted together for nearly 20 minutes. Then the Countess rose, and walking alone across the wide drawing-room, sat down at Newland Archer's side. It was not the custom in New York drawing-rooms for a lady to get up and walk away from one gentleman in order to seek the company of another. Etiquette required that she should wait, immovable as an idol, while the men who wished to converse with her succeeded each other at her side. But the Countess was apparently unaware of having broken any rule. She sat at perfect ease in a corner of the sofa beside Archer and looked at him with the kindest eyes. "I want you to talk to me about May," she said. Instead of answering her, he asked, "You knew the Duke before?" "Oh, yes. We used to see him every winter at Nice. He's very fond of gambling. He used to come to the house a great deal." She said it in the simplest manner, as if she had said, "He's fond of wildflowers." And after a moment she added candidly, "I think he's the dullest man I ever met." This pleased her companion so much that he forgot the slight shock her previous remark had caused him. It was undeniably exciting to meet a lady who found the van der Luyden's Duke dull, and dared to utter the opinion. He longed to question her, to hear more about the life of which her careless words had given him so illuminating a glimpse. But he feared to touch on distressing memories, and before he could think of anything to say, she had strayed back to her original subject. "May is a darling. I've seen no young girl in New York so handsome and so intelligent. Are you very much in love with her?" Newland Archer reddened and laughed, "as much as a man can be." She continued to consider him thoughtfully, as if not to miss any shade of meaning in what he said.
"Do you think, then, there is a limit?"
"To being in love? If there is, I haven't found it." She glowed with sympathy.
"Ah, it's really and truly a romance.
The most romantic of romances."
"How delightful. And you found it all out for yourselves? It was not in the least arranged for you?"
Archer looked at her incredulously.
"Have you forgotten," he asked with a smile, "that in our country we don't allow our marriages to be arranged for us?"
A dusky blush rose to her cheek, and he instantly regretted his words.
"Yes," she answered, "I'd forgotten. You must forgive me if I sometimes make these mistakes. I don't always remember that everything here is good that was bad where I've come from."
She looked down at her Viennese fan of eagle feathers, and he saw that her lips trembled.
"I'm so sorry," he said impulsively. "But you are among friends here, you know."
"Yes, I know.
Wherever I go, I have that feeling. That's why I came home. I want to forget everything else, to become a complete American again, like the Mingotts and Wellens and you and your delightful mother and all the other good people here tonight. Ah, here's May arriving,
and you will want to hurry away to her," she added, but without moving.
And her eyes turned back from the door to rest on the young man's face. The drawing rooms were beginning to fill up with after-dinner guests, and following Madame Olenska's glance, Archer saw May Welland entering with her mother. In her dress of white and silver, with a wreath of silver blossoms in her hair, the tall girl looked like a Diana just alight from the chase.
"Oh," said Archer, "I have so many rivals. You see, she's already surrounded. There's the Duke being introduced."
"Then stay with me a little longer," Madame Olenska said in a low tone, just touching his knee with her plumed fan. It was the lightest touch, but it thrilled him like a caress.
"Yes, let me stay,"
he answered in the same tone, hardly knowing what he said. But just then Mr. van der Luyden came up, followed by old Mr. Urban Dagonet. The Countess greeted them with her grave smile, and Archer, feeling his host's admonitory glance on him, rose and surrendered his seat. Madame Olenska held out her hand as if to bid him good-bye.
"Tomorrow, then, after 5, I shall expect you," she said, and then turned back to make room for Mr. Dagonet.
"Tomorrow," Archer heard himself repeating, though there had been no engagement, and during their talk she had given him no hint that she wished to see him again.
As he moved away, he saw Lawrence Lefferts, tall and resplendent, leading his wife up to be introduced, and heard Gertrude Lefferts say, as she beamed on the Countess with her large, unperceiving smile,
"But I think we used to go to dancing school together when we were children."
Behind her, waiting their turn to name themselves to the Countess, Archer noticed a number of the recalcitrant couples who had declined to meet her at Mrs. Lovell Mingott's. As Mrs. Archer remarked, when the van der Luydens chose, they knew how to give a lesson. The wonder was that they chose so seldom. The young man felt a touch on his arm and saw Mrs. van der Luyden looking down on him from the pure eminence of black velvet and the family diamonds.
"It was good of you, dear Newland, to devote yourself so unselfishly to Madame Olenska. I told your cousin Henry he must really come to the rescue."
He was aware of smiling at her vaguely, and she added, as if condescending to his natural shyness,
"I've never seen May look lovelier. The Duke thinks her the handsomest girl in the room."